JSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, a small Canadian lake records humanity's impact on planet Earth.
It's Ontario's version of Walden Pond. It's sky water. It's this mirror that we see ourselves in, and it's this mirror that we've looked at the inhabitants of this land in. And we don't want that inhabitation to stop. We want to continue. We want the generations that come after us to continue and love and learn the bounty of this landscape.
On the floor of Canada's House of Commons, an old Nazi veteran gets a standing ovation.
What credibility Canada had on the international stage has been completely eviscerated. This country has been disgraced. The only hope we have for rehabilitating the reputation of this country is to clean house at the highest levels of politics in this country. And we have to come to terms with the fact that we've been whitewashing Nazism in this country ever since the Second World War ended.
And when official enemies are to blame, Canada calls for justice. For a beloved ally, Canada calls for justice to be suspended.
Canadian government's position is completely hypocritical. They invoke the law when they think it's going to advance their political ambitions, and when they think it's going to be harmful to their political ambitions, then they say, well, this is a matter that shouldn't be sorted by law.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. Before getting into the details, help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Back in the early 2000s, Dutch chemist Paul Crutzen suggested that humans have pushed planet Earth into a new epoch, the Anthropocene, Crutzen called it. This past spring, a scientific panel presented its own geological definition of the Anthropocene. The core of that definition, the Anthropocene's golden spike, the one spot on Earth where the start of Earth's new epoch is best observed in surface sediments. The panel's choice? Crawford Lake in southern Ontario. It's a meromictic lake, so its waters don't turn over, and its bottom sediments are perfectly preserved. They've been recording human activities for 12,000 years. I visited Crawford Lake in the company of some of its greatest fans. The first one you'll hear is Brenna Bartley, Manager of Education and Outreach with Halton Region Conservation Authority.
So, I mean, here we are. This is gorgeous. We're standing around on the boardwalk at Crawford Lake, and one would be forgiven to think that one was right in the middle of, well, wilderness. It's not quite. It's obviously developed because this boardwalk is here. But here we are, and we're talking about this lake that's, it's a pristine lake. It's sort of pristine. But here we are in the heart of the most, arguably the most developed place in all of North America. It's an interesting place to document changes to the planet, given the fact that it's right in the middle of Anthropocene land.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting conversation to have with people because it is a bit jarring. Right, because they come here because it looks like you're up in northern Ontario. So it's perfectly protected. Conservation Halton doesn't allow swimming, fishing, boating. We're very committed to the protection of this body of water. You can see snapping turtles swimming by when you're standing on the lakeshore. You can see the fish. You can see herons if you come down in the morning. It's a beautiful, beautiful space right on the top of the Niagara Escarpment, very protected. And then you stand to talk to people, and they come for that peace. And they almost feel like you're shattering that peace by bringing in the concepts that come in through the sediment. My team of educators often talk about, how do you work with that? How do you help somebody through the emotional experience of being someplace where it's so peaceful, it looks so perfect, but the story that's in the sediment is telling something that's very different. But I often find that when I'm working with people, the curiosity factor, the fact that they're learning and they're lighting up with that new knowledge, really helps people to navigate that. They're fascinated with this story. They're fascinated with the idea that a body of water like this one can record human history in such great detail. And it is a really accessible way for people to talk about climate change.
My name is Tammy Morris. to me, the biggest challenge is going to be the human change that's required to turn the sparks that are lit here into action. It's the leaders that, you know, make these major decisions that have to be convinced. We can yell and scream all we want, but until they listen and buy in, to me, it's just a huge uphill battle. Hopefully they get it soon.
I see little kids, like these little kids who went by, like, what's the earth going to be like when they're my age?
You know? Actually, when I was in Berlin...
Introduce yourself.
Francine McCarthy, Brock University. When I was in Berlin in May for the Anthropocene Working Group meeting, Greta Thunberg came to the Reichstag as one of her climate action, forgotten what they're called, but the young people for climate action. And I was impressed. It is the young people who have to influence from the bottom what the old people like us are doing and accept what we have done to the planet and to make change. And it is not for people who are 60 that we need this change to happen. We'll be dead before it really becomes horrid. It's for people who are like those little kids we saw walk by who are 5. They're inheriting what the first world has done for so long. And to be fair, people in the 50s and 60s, A, had no idea the impact they were having, and B, we all thought we'd be annihilated soon anyway, so didn't matter. But now that we're committed not to be annihilated, hopefully, it's the long run, and it's the long run for the little children, not for the decision makers, but for the people they listen to, which their grandchildren will hopefully be major contributors to change.
It's interesting what you said, that the lake is watching us.
Oh, yeah.
The lake is watching and listening and recording.
Yeah.
It's sort of like...
Introduce yourself.
Ben O'Reilly, Conservation Halton. I always equate it to it's Ontario's version of Walden Pond. And, it, you know, that's an analogy that's been made before. And it's sky water. It's this mirror that we see ourselves in, and it's this mirror that we've looked at the inhabitants of this land in, and we don't want that inhabitation to stop. We want to continue. We want the generations that come after us to continue and love and learn the bounty of this landscape. And to Francine's point, that requires all of us to take this seriously, because it is serious. All of the numbers and all of the studies show us that it's serious. And the 5-year-olds, the little children, I have a 4-year-old. That's why I do this. It's important. And the lake is just one resource that practitioners can use to show everyone the severity of our situation. It's not the full story, but it is so fulsome that we would be remiss if we didn't use it to all of its rigor to promote this. And I always say that it's the mirror that we see ourselves in, and it's the mirror that we can show our actions and the impact that they've had back, you know, hundreds to even thousands of years ago. We can change the landscape locally, or we can change it globally. Unfortunately, right now we're changing it globally. It'd be nice if we got back to just changing it locally, but it can tell both stories in a way that we really need to listen.
Tim Patterson, Carleton University. I think Crawford Lake is more of a poster child to document changes that have gone on, the indigenous communities that lived here through the centuries, periods when it was quiet, the lake was the limnology of the lake was different, and then when settlers came back again in the late 19th century, they began to change it again, and now we're trying, through the efforts of Conservation Halton, to make this a place that people can come and understand what's gone on before, but to show how we might be proper stewards of the environment. And you think in a country like Canada, which literally hundreds of thousands of lakes, it doesn't take much to seriously negatively impact a lake. And that happens everywhere. You go to cottage country, you go anywhere. Anytime they practically cut a tree down, you're starting to impact these lakes. So we need to understand how to live better with nature and be able to understand, to be better stewards of these lakes that we're living with, to help preserve them for the coming generations. And, you know, we're in an era right now, it's COP27 is going on, and I predict it's not going to end up any better than any other COPs that have gone on. And it's mainly because everybody's pointing fingers all the time. They always say, well, you guys have to do clean up your act. So I think maybe for people in Canada, it's time for us, perhaps, we have an advantage that we're a very developed nation. We can develop wonderful technologies and just give them away. Just don't argue about how we can use these technologies, not only to clean the air, but also to help us have a better environment all around. And I think that's something that, go back to locally versus nationally versus internationally, that Crawford Lake would present itself as as the golden spike for the Anthropocene, an opportunity for us to use this as something that perhaps going forward we can use as a sort of a flagpole for us to say this is how we could make things better.
The Anthropocene Working Group's formal definition of the Anthropocene, with Crawford Lake as its golden spike, will be submitted to its parent body later this fall. A final decision rejecting or adopting the Anthropocene as a new epoch in Earth's history could be announced in August 2024. At the 37th Congress of the International Union of Geological Sciences in South Korea. For more information about Crawford Lake, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Of the Canadian House of Commons in action typically don't go viral. Late last month, a seemingly innocent act of courtesy by the Commons Speaker sparked national furor and global media coverage. Moments after a speech by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Speaker Anthony Rota called on MPs to stand up and applaud an old man sitting in the visitor's balcony, Yaroslav Hanka. A 98-year-old Ukrainian veteran had valiantly fought the Russians in World War II, Rota declared. Everyone rose and clapped. As it turned out, Hanka was a veteran of one of Nazi Germany's most notorious divisions, the Galicia Division of the Waffen-SS. Under the command of Heinrich Himmler, the division committed atrocious crimes across western Ukraine and Poland. Hanka was 18 years old when he volunteered with unknown political beliefs. There's no evidence he participated in atrocities. Sometime in the mid-1950s, Hanka emigrated to Canada. So did hundreds of other veterans of Nazi units. Monuments would be erected across Canada, commemorating their courageous struggles. The GPM spoke with Dmitry Lascaris about Yaroslav Hanka and Canada's reputation as a place where old Nazis went to pasture. Lascaris is a lawyer, human rights activist, and journalist. Dmitry, I want to ask you who Yaroslav Hanka is. But before you answer that question, can you tell me, right, like in the media now, this is a huge media storm, and people are saying it was all unwitting. Nobody in the House of Commons knew who Yaroslav Hanka is or was. What's your quick response to that idea that this was totally by accident? Nobody knew quickly, but then tell me who he is.
My short answer is we just don't know what happened here. And what we do know is that this is so embarrassing to the standing of Canada's parliament that we can't trust the people who are saying these things to be honest with us. So we need to do a lot more investigation. And I'm not going to purport to know all the answers, but I think we should exercise a very high degree of skepticism for a whole bunch of reasons we can get into about what they're telling us. In terms of who he is, I'd never heard of this man myself prior to his being declared a hero in Parliament and eliciting not one but two standing ovations. What we know, or I know from the media reports, is that Jarosław Hanka was born in Poland, spent most of the early years of his life in Ukraine, and volunteered in 1943 for a Ukrainian division of the Waffen-SS. What happened at that point in time was that the German Nazis were taking a beating in the Soviet Union, in particularly in Ukraine, which at that point was part of the Soviet Union. And in order to reconstitute their army, they raised a division within Ukraine of volunteers, and some 80,000 Ukrainians volunteered, and I think they ended up taking about 10,000. Jarosław Hanka was one of them, and this Ukrainian division participated. We don't know exactly what Jarosław Hanka did himself and what he saw, but we know that that division was complicit in heinous war crimes and was under the command of Himmler, who was, you know, the architect of some of the most monstrous war crimes in history. And the last detail I'll give about Hanka, which is one that really stands out for me, is that he publicly declared that 1941 to 1943 were the happiest years of his life. Think about that. Our parliament gave a standing ovation to a man who publicly declared that one of the years, the year in which he volunteered for the Ukrainian division of the Waffen-SS, was one of the happiest years of his life.
No, I mean, he was represented, if I understand correctly, he was represented as having fought against the Russians during the war. And I mean, we all know that the Russians were allies of the Americans and the French and the British. And if you were fighting the Russians during the war, you were a German, you were a Nazi. So this seems to beg credulity that they would have, on the one hand, actually lauded him for having fought the Russians during the war. And this is why Zelensky was there, right, clapping, you know, really happily. It sort of begs credulity that these people did not know who this guy was, and particularly somebody like Chrystia Freeland. Surely she must have known who he was.
You know, I've been saying to anybody who listened that this is not an accident. This is the inevitable byproduct. When, where, and how something like this was going to happen, nobody could say. But that Canada would eventually become completely scandalized by its whitewashing and legitimization of Nazis was inevitable. It's just a question of when, where, and how. And I think what happened, again, we need to do a hell of a lot more investigating before we determine exactly how this unfolded. But I think what happened was that after decades, really decades of whitewashing, Nazis who came to Canada in the aftermath of the Second World War, there was a certain degree of political complacency that set in. And it got to such a degree of complacency that there are people within the Canadian hierarchy, and one of them may well be Chrystia Freeland, who thought that this was kind of the coming out party for those who had sided with the Nazis, but for the purpose, quote unquote, of securing freedom from Soviet oppression. And I think that that complacency has come back in a big way to damage the Canadian elite, the political elite. It's not just about the Liberals, not at all. It's about the Conservatives as well. It's about the NDP. It is sadly also about the Green Party of Canada elite. All of them, to one degree or another, have been participating in the whitewashing of the Nazis in Ukraine. And this was just an accident waiting to happen. So who knew about it? Who knew? I think it's entirely possible that Chrystia Freeland knew that he had been a volunteer in the Galician Division and that she didn't think that this was going to be a scandal. And frankly, David, I think what really, I mean, I was on Twitter, as were many others who have been criticizing our support for this Ukrainian regime, complaining about the fact that they had honored a Nazi for some 24 hours before anybody actually said anything from the mainstream political class. And what really forced their hand was when the mainstream Jewish organization said, we have to act. B'nai B'rith came out, made a statement. The Seemann Wiesenthal Center made a statement. The Center for Jewish and Israel Affairs made a statement. As you well know, I don't generally agree with them, but I think in this particular case, they were 100% right. And I'm saddened to say that if they hadn't said anything, I think that all of us who were complaining vigorously about the honoring of this Nazi in our parliament would have been ignored. But thankfully, they came forward. And I think that at that point, that just changed the tide of the world.
But again, following up on what you've just said, Simon Wiesenthal Center knew who Yaroslav Hunka was. B'nai B'rith knew who he was. Sidra, all those folks, mainstream Jewish establishment in Canada, knew who he was. So it just astonishes me. They didn't know. They didn't know. And I just also want to, you know, you've already kind of addressed that. Canada for decades has had a reputation for being a place where Nazis hang out, perhaps even safer than in the United States. And I gather Pierre Trudeau, the father, told Irving Abella, who at the time was the head of the Canadian Jewish Congress, this is in the 1980s, quote, this is, I guess, Irving Abella's quote, recalling what Pierre Trudeau said to him, quote, they were, the Canadians, Trudeau, were afraid of exacerbating relationships between Jews and Eastern European ethnic communities by calling out the presence of Nazis in Canada. And the Duchesne Commission in 1986 that was struck by Brian Mulroney, a conservative, found that there were somewhere on the order of 100 former Nazis hiding out in Canada alive at that time in the mid-1980s, and perhaps another 100 who had died. So this is long-standing history.
Yep. So this is so important to stress that we don't really know exactly what happened. But if I had to hazard a guess, what I would say to you, because let's be honest, I mean, at the one hand, I'm very I'm pleasantly surprised that Sija and B'nai B'rith and the Simon Wiesenthal Center called out the Canadian Parliament for doing this, because this involves some political risk. After all, this was, you know, an event that was designed to generate public support for NATO's proxy war in Ukraine, and calling out the Canadian government was potentially going to compromise its ability to generate public support for fueling this proxy war. What I imagine happened, but I don't really know, is that they were reluctant, the leadership of these organizations were reluctant to condemn Canada's parliament. But as the news that parliament had honored a Nazi became viral, the membership of these organizations, the grassroots of B'nai B'rith and Sija and the Simon Wiesenthal Center, began to apply intense pressure upon their leaders to act. And at a certain point, they felt it necessary to go out on a limb, as it were, politically, and condemn the Canadian government for what it did in an event which was designed quite obviously to generate more support, more public support for fueling the proxy war in Ukraine. That's what I think happened. Do I know that that's what happened? I don't know. All I do know is that the Canadian government took absolutely no action. It ignored literally thousands of people on Twitter who were complaining vigorously and other social media about the fact that this man had been honored in Canada's parliament, until these three organizations intervened. And at that point, the Canadian government was no longer in a position politically where it could just ignore what had happened. I think that that's how things unfolded. And I think it's a very sad commentary on Canadian politics. But I'll tell you one thing, David. I think what credibility Canada had on the international stage, and there wasn't much before this happened, has been completely eviscerated. This country has been disgraced. We are now a laughingstock on the international stage. And as I've just written on my website, the only hope we have for rehabilitating the reputation of this country is to clean house at the highest levels of politics in this country. And we have to come to terms with the fact that we've been whitewashing Nazism in this country ever since the Second World War ended.
And so this raises a question, Dmitry Lascaris, whether or not high levels of the Canadian government. I mean, I point to a person like Chrystia Freeland, who's been written about a lot vis-a-vis her notorious grandfather, who was a Nazi sympathizer, publisher. Did she know that? Does she know it? Is she whitewashing it? This has been in the media for years. Whether or not, at their heart, the Canadian elite are just naturally more attuned to and sympathetic towards fascism and extreme right-wing tendencies than they are to, you know, dare I say it, socialism and liberalism. And people just blithely say, leftists in Canada blithely say, oh, the Canadian government is fascist, which is kind of polemical and rhetorical and the rest of it. But does this not reveal something about the imprint of Canadian political DNA?
Absolutely. You know, and I try to stay away from using the word fascism in, you know, and even to a degree, I've tried to stay away from using the word socialism and so forth, because these things have come to be mean different things to different people and to be manipulated. And what I will say is this, I'm not going to say, I would never say at this stage that I think that the Canadian government is fascist, but on the political spectrum, you know, with socialism being at one end and fascism on the other, I have no doubt that the Canadian political elite leans far closer to the fascism end of the spectrum than it does to the socialism end of the spectrum. And I think that this absolutely disgraceful event has demonstrated that in spades. Historians have recounted the fact that this government welcomed these Ukrainian Nazis into the country because they viewed them as being a bulwark against communism. They were more concerned about preventing the spread of communism and socialism in Canada than they were about preventing the spread of Nazism in Canada. So, you know, what does that tell you about where their sympathies lie? I think it's pretty clear. As for Chrystia Freeland, at this stage, there is no doubt that Chrystia Freeland knew. There's no doubt that she knew that her grandfather was a Nazi collaborator. And I say that because this was confirmed that she knew it by the mainstream media, by the Globe and Mail, by, you know, the Post media. And these organizations would only say such a thing if they had incontrovertible evidence to back it up. Because fundamentally, they are politically aligned with people like Chrystia Freeland. She knew it. She lied about it. Not only did she lie about it, but after the invasion began, she participated in a pro-Ukraine rally in Toronto in which she donned the scarf of the odious, murderous, fascist Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. And when she was called out for it, she deleted the tweet in which she posted a photograph of her donning that scarf. I mean, she's, and there's never been any consequences for her. Trudeau's never punished her for it. In fact, after the mainstream media revealed that she had lied about her grandfather being a Nazi collaborator, Trudeau elevated her from the position of foreign minister to the position of finance minister and deputy prime minister. She was effectively rewarded for lying about her grandfather's Nazi proclivities. So, you know, do we really at this stage have any reason to doubt which way the sympathies of the Canadian political elite lie? Do they lie more in the direction of fascism or more in the direction of socialism? I mean, come on. What more evidence do we need than this?
Dimitri Lascaris is a lawyer, activist, and journalist based in Montreal and Greece. I'll link to Dimitri's posts at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. For as little as $5 a month, you'll be helping to make this weekly news package happen. In 2019, in the midst of another Canadian scandal, Chrystia Freeland, Canada's foreign minister at the time, declared that international law wasn't a smorgasbord to pick and choose from. Freeland was being coy. When it comes to China or Russia or Iran or Syria or Venezuela or other countries of that sort, Canada calls for international law to be strictly enforced. When it comes to Israel, it calls for the law to be deep-sixed. Late last December, along with two dozen other Israeli allies, Canada voted against a UN resolution requesting the International Court of Justice to render an advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's half-century-long occupation of Palestine. The resolution passed,
and the ICJ is now preparing to render that opinion this past July. Canada urged the court to step back. Rendering a legal opinion would only harden positions, Canada argued. The Israel-Palestine conflict